Hi, this is Chaz Palminteri, and if you're thinking about getting your eyes done, the only person to see is Dr. Rothman of LASIK of Nevada. I flew all the way from New York to be here, and Dr. Rothman did my eyes. And all I could say is, it's a miracle. I could see. You see Dr. Rothman of LASIK of Nevada.
Living in Las Vegas starts now. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome from Las Vegas, Nevada, that groovy little podcast that gives you a true first-person look into what it's like to call Sin City your home, the Living in Las Vegas podcast. And now your host, a man who clearly needs some kind of introduction, otherwise you wouldn't know who he was. Mr. Scott Whitney.
I've decided our first contest for the day will be if you could tell me how many different couples shots there were in the beginning of that montage. Who was done by who? Super Sam. If you can tell us how many of those montages, we've decided that the most recently created supervisor here, Wayne, is a supervisor. He's going to give one of his paychecks to you. And I thought that was nice of him.
Wow, Wayne.
Thank you, Wayne. Big hand for Wayne.
Wow.
Thank you, Wayne.
Thank you.
He is pimping Wayne.
Then you all find out how little the casino industry really pays.
Anyways, hey, welcome everybody to the Living in Las Vegas extravaganza on the Vegas Video Network. I am your humble host, Scott Whitney. Konnichiwa. It's been a while. We've missed you. And I'm joined by my naughty jelly sweet. That sounds for the radio people. If you people on the radio actually saw this video, right now we are basking nude in a bowl of jello. I don't think that's right.
Wow, that is a visual.
That's good. Anyways, this, ladies and gentlemen, is the great and powerful Melissa Whitney. Big hand. Look at her. Oh, that's like the Japanese kids do.
Aye.
Deuces.
All right. Deuces. East side. Anyways, on today's show, we've decided to break the mold a little bit. We're not going to do that four-segment thing that we've been doing. Actually, I'm growing a little weary of the four-segment format. There's a good chance I might blow it up because it feels like it's restraining me a little bit, and we're not going to do that much anymore.
You probably don't do restraint very well.
I do.
You
not.
Don't.
You're right. You're right. That's true. But what we're going to do is we're going to talk about a pretty serious subject. We've been away from the show for the last couple weeks, and I've been preoccupied pretty extensively since December of last year. Got uber preoccupied in mid-February of this year, and it's all come to a sad conclusion. But we learned a lot of this from this experience with regards to Las Vegas and healthcare in Las Vegas and all the different things that are associated with healthcare in Las Vegas. So I thought, you know, I did a Facebook post today saying that this is important if you live in Las Vegas. Actually, it's important no matter where you live, because much of what we'll be talking about is relatable regardless of whether you live in Las Vegas or San Antonio, for that matter. So we're gonna kind of break away from our regular kind of format. We're just going to kind of go through a little stream of consciousness. I didn't really provide the crew with a real clear outline. We're just going to do kind of what we used to do and just say, here's what's happened to us, and here are some of the things that we thought were good. Here are some of the things that we thought were mediocre, and here are some of the things that we thought were reprehensible, and that should be fixed. But also, at the end, I'm going to make it a point to speak about something that I think is coming down the pipe that I think will be amazing news for folks. This will be just for Las Vegas, but we'll hold that off to the end. I do want to thank our staff for being here today. It's been a while. They've done a great job in holding up the fort while I've been gone. A hello to he who remains Jacob. He Who Remains Pimpin' Wayne. And there on the corner is Slammin' Sammy.
Yay! I'm giving you guys a big clap.
It's a good-looking crew. Now, we're going to take a quick break, but before we do that, I do want to say this. Happy birthday tomorrow. Happy birthday to you tomorrow. Happy birthday, dear Melissa. Happy birthday to you.
Now, thank you. 29 again.
That's it. It's only her fourth anniversary of 29. That's well, why I'm the best husband ever. Hey, here's a question for everybody out watching today. This is an important question. What do you get the woman who has what every woman wants? Me.
Okay. Are you wanting a list?
Yeah.
Do you want a list?
I would have thought that I'm enough.
Well, the Nordstrom sale starts tomorrow. I mean, it doesn't start tomorrow, but I have that access so I can start early.
Well, how would I gift that to you? See, I'm confused.
You would meet me at the mall at 3:30 tomorrow afternoon, at which time I shall begin my shopping extravaganza. But on a good note, you know.
Good note for you. That makes me the best husband
ever.
See,
I can be low maintenance because really I just want a pizza tomorrow.
But on a good note, Amex has a 21-day grace period.
On a good note, I just want to go out for pizza tomorrow night.
Yeah, and you want me to meet you at Nordstrom's.
Well,
maybe I could buy you a pen.
You were saying I can't just take you out for pizza.
Right.
And I said, but that's what I want to do.
Right.
And I said, I'm low maintenance like that.
You are. Because when I think of you, I think of you as low maintenance.
Well, I could be saying let's go to...
Anyways, if besides the 3:30 meeting at Nordstrom's, sounds like, oh yeah, there might be some cussing on this show, by the way. And the best part about that is Sam or Jacob's going to edit that out in the radio version. We're letting down our hair, which has gotten a little grayer lately. It's been good. Oh, by the way, you know, screw it. Anyways, let's take a quick break so we can kind of get it all together here. And we'll talk about healthcare and my mom a little bit. This is the Living in Las Vegas podcast. We'll be right back.
Oh, hi. I'm Kelly Clinton. That sucked. I wonder if Joan Rivers is watching.
Oh, please. Oh, my God. Who cares?
I don't have a different one. You know who watches this show? Wayne Newton.
You got that right, Kelly. I think you're absolutely beautiful. And talented young lady. 5, 6, 9, 12. Darker shade.
More camera time for me.
Hey, I wonder if Cher's watching.
Oh, please. I have so many other things to do.
Woo! Hi, I'm Kelly Clinton. I'm the host of Talk Tales, and you're watching the Vegas Video Network. That was horrible.
She's pretty good, isn't she?
Hey, can I make a? I want to make a recommendation to Kelly.
Yeah.
I think she needs to do a Scott Whitney.
Impersonate me?
Yes, absolutely.
My voice is too low.
I think that would be hilarious.
I don't think it'd be that funny.
I don't. You guys think it'd be funny?
Another
cricket.
No. What would you do? I don't do anything.
God, I think it'd be way better.
All right, so let's talk a little bit. So we, some time ago, back in...
this is hilarious.
I wish we could shoot that, because that is the best crew. It's like an iceberg.
Okay, that is hilarious, that. Sam.
You know, we had somebody on top of the food chain once who... Go to camera two.
Why do we have a big thing of ice here?
See that? Who actually made his own ice. You remember that cat? He came in here and he brought in his own ice.
He was the inventor of...
Oh, of the sidecar. The guy who invented the sidecar brought in his own ice. And I was like, man, that's pretty cool. We invent our own ice too. You see how it was a big chunk? Here's the secret on how to do that. You put a bag of ice in a small little mini refrigerator and you pack it in the little itty bitty freezer and you let it sit for 2 weeks. Guess what happens? Little icebergs. See? I don't need to be
That's been sitting in there
fancy.
For 2 weeks.
It's just water. I'm okay. All right. Let's get serious, shall we? All right. So back in February, might have been March, I had mentioned that my mom was going through some medical challenges. We mentioned it on the same show that I interviewed Bob O'Neill. And I believe in that, on that interview, or in that episode, I should say, I mentioned that she was diagnosed with common bile duct cancer. So I wanted to kind of back up and go over this process again, because that was wrong. That was not the correct diagnosis. And I wanted to walk people through it, and not just to talk about, you know, the maudlin part of it, but to say what your rights are here. Because what I discovered in going through this is that this is being in the healthcare environment with a loved one is especially intimidating and unpleasant and scary a little bit. And I wanted to kind of share some of our experiences, good, some of the mistakes we made, some of the right things I think we did, and some other ideas as well. I mean, this is basically the notes for the show. So it started off in February, and Melissa and I were at my mom's house, and she was jaundiced. Jaundice is the yellowing of your skin, you know. And for babies, you know, I've had a couple kids, and both of our kids, as I recall, displayed jaundice when they were first born, about a week into it. It's pretty common, doesn't mean much. For an adult, jaundice can be a problem. It also could be nothing more severe than gallstones in your common bile duct, and I'll explain what that is in a second. But we noticed that she was jaundiced, and she had been that way for a while. And you know, my mom is like most of us. She really doesn't like doctors.
Well, let me just say, she had noticed it
before
for
we
a
did.
While,
yeah, yeah,
and said nothing to us. We went over there to have dinner, and she was jaundiced, and immediately we were like,
right,
you need to get in the car and go to the doctor. Right? It wasn't like we let her be jaundiced for a while.
No, right. That's a good point. So we had noticed it the day it happened, or the day we noticed it, we were like, hey, you know, didn't you say, I thought maybe you'd put on too much yellow makeup or something? Because when I'm
it was so yellow.
Today I'm going.
It was so yellow and so unnatural that I was like, we were eating dinner at her house with her, and I was looking at her, and I'm like, something's not right. Yeah. And it actually looked like she had, you know, you don't know this, but when you go get makeup, sometimes the tone is off, right? And so something just absolutely was not right. It just looked very strange to me and very yellow. Like, anyways, it was bizarre, and I actually thought it was makeup.
Yeah. So my mom and I have my mom was abroad in the best sense of the word. And so we had a very straightforward relationship in that if I thought that she was doing something wrong, I would tell her, and vice versa. And I said, well, you know, look, this is not the way it's supposed to be. We need to go to a doctor. And she basically told me, I'm not going to a doctor. You know, this was on a Friday. We'll get through the weekend and, you know, call me Monday and we'll set an appointment. So I played the, you know, I'm the scared son card.
It was Thursday. Friday you called her and did the scared son.
That's right. And said, hey, look, I couldn't sleep last night. I'm really worried about that. We need to get you to the emergency room. And this, you know, the emergency room idea, you know, there's a lot of people who complain about, a lot of folks use the emergency room as your first go-to for health care.
Like if you have a cold.
Yeah, so maybe a cold's not a good idea, but for a lot of things, for instance, I've been in the emergency room within the last month, and I wouldn't have done it any other way, because it gets you done. It gets you figured out pretty quickly, and hopefully I'll remember why I was in the emergency room. I'll bring that up. Anyway, so I told her, hey, look, we need to get this thing dealt with. It's just the right thing to do. She said, okay. So we took her to the emergency room. That must have been a Saturday then, right?
She convinced us. I mean, she was just fighting us really the whole way. But she did agree. Okay, let me get some things done, because I think she really thought, I'm going to be in the hospital a long time. Yep. Let me just do a few things around the house, and I'll go on Saturday.
Yep. So we took her to the emergency room, and this is at Mountain View Hospital. Now, the reason why we went to Mountain View Hospital is two reasons. First, my mom lived in Summerlin City, Sun City Summerlin, I should say. The other reason is I had spent some time in Mountain View Hospital in 2006. I had heart palpitations and went to the emergency room and had an angiogram and all kinds of unpleasant things. It ended up being that I was okay. But I, for the most part, was pleasantly surprised by who I dealt with. There was one doctor who was a complete and utter jackass that I didn't like at all, a cardiologist, and another doctor who is probably one of the best doctors I've ever dealt with, Dr. Navid.
Kazemi,
who's my cardiologist today, and is amazing. Kazemi, oof, awesome. Anyway, so we take her to the emergency room, and we have her, you know, we go through the check-in, and it's interesting, Mountain View has these billboards now that say wait time is 15 minutes, 10 minutes, whatever. Which is amazing, I think, advertising. Yeah, there's Mountain View Hospital right there. Very good.
And I don't think we're really going to discuss a lot of doctors' names here, but...
I'm going to discuss a couple. Probably. We'll see.
Oh, really? Because I want to un-mic.
Huh? You want to what?
I want to un-mic.
Right.
Just kidding. Yeah. I don't want them to sue me.
I'm not afraid of any of these fuckers. Not one of them. Not one of you fuckers am I afraid of. And there are some doctors who are godlike and did the best job I've ever seen. And I want to praise them as well. But there's some of you out there who didn't do good work.
I'm just saying, I don't think we need to discuss names.
Yeah, we'll see. Maybe we won't. Call me and I'll tell you who to avoid. So we went there and so it's a standard thing. It's a triage environment. So they look at you and they go, okay, that yellow is probably not the right color you should be. They checked her blood pressure. Her blood pressure was high. She never knew she had blood pressure. And they said, okay, let's get you in the emergency room. And so we started going through the emergency room process. Now, the emergency room in Mountain View, I would argue, is actually pretty good. You know, we actually ended up going there four separate times in the course of 4 weeks or 5 weeks. So we saw good and bad and indifferent, right? I mean, you would say that there are sometimes it was very, very good, and sometimes it took a little longer than we had hoped. But it's emergency room. I mean, it's what
you expect. Well, and part of the problem was, you know, we were there right when everybody was getting, you know, kind of cold and flu season. You know, we saw a lot of cold and flu. And, I mean, even myself, when I was really sick with the bronchitis, I'm certain I got it at the hospital.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, we were dealing with emergency rooms during these sort of kind of peak, you know, kind of illness for those kinds of things. So, yeah. You know, there were a lot of people in there for those kind of things. Overall, though, you
all
know.
Right. So they went in there and they did the blood tests. And so here's a bit of interesting stuff. The reason why your poop is brown is because there's a chemical that is secreted from your liver called bilirubin. And it's in the bile, and that's what makes your poop brown. Well, one of the indications of jaundice is that your poop becomes less brown, and your urine becomes more brown. And so she had seen that, and it's been so long. The bilirubin count's usually in the onesie, twosies, and hers was 25. Is that right? Yeah, it was 25 times more than it should be. They recognized there was something going on with the common bile duct. So here's how this works. Imagine you've got a liver. The liver takes bile and puts it down to a common bile duct. Common bile duct goes down. Your gallbladder connects to that. And then it goes down a little farther, goes through the pancreas into the duodenum, and then does all the most of your digestion happens there, and then it goes through your bowels.
And the pancreas bile duct also connects to that.
Right, and the pancreas provides enzymes that are also used to provide to help you digest food. So they went in, and a doctor was. So when you go in, so here's one of the things I will tell you right now: it is important to have a primary doctor. I don't have one. Melissa, do you have one?
I do.
You do. My mom didn't have one. And so what ends up happening, if you don't have a primary doctor, one is assigned to you. If you do, that primary doctor actually is responsible for being the quarterback of your experience. So depending on your illness, you're going to have many different doctors. That was the case for us. And it is the primary doctor, the internist, who then gathers that information and should, if they know what they're doing, provide a unified front. Here's a story in consumable content, But mom did not have a primary doctor, so one was assigned to her. And I will not give you her name. So we went through it. They said, yep, your bilirubin's high. There's something going on. And so a GI, a gastrointestinal doctor, was then assigned to him, her. Won't give you his name. And they did an ECRP, I think it was called, or an ERCP. It's one of those two. What they do is they take a camera, they put it down your throat, down through your stomach, and they take a look around and see what they can find. So they did that, and then they also scrape the common bile duct to see if they can find any cancers. So they went through that process, didn't find any, well, they did the scraping, they didn't find any cancers as a result of that, but they did find a stricture, a compression of the common bile duct, that was causing the problem. So they put a stent in there, and they said, well, that stent's in there, that's, you know, that will solve the jaundice problem, and, you know, we'll keep looking around. So here's the first thing that I should have thought about, and I failed here, I feel, and that is the stent is not a solution. It just solves the jaundice problem, but it doesn't explain what caused the stricture in the first place, right? So we did that. Now, she ended up having
That's part of why they were, when you say they're doing scraping, what they're actually doing is biopsies.
Right.
So they do scrape and they do, you know, they brush and they actually do, you know, cut a bit of tissue out.
Yeah.
So all of that is to see if they find cancer and if that is what's causing the stricture.
Right. Yeah,
and they do all
right.
kinds of pictures, you know,
that's
they
fair.
Do, you know, CAT scans, all kinds of things.
Right.
Also to see if they see anything like a tumor causing the stricture.
That's a good point. And so I'm speaking from an everyman's perspective. I'm not a doctor. So this is how it was for me as I was watching what was happening. So she ended up having high blood pressure, they discovered. And so they gave her a couple drugs for high blood pressure. And they gave her some drugs for an ulcer.
Cholesterol.
And cholesterol.
Because your mom had not been to the doctor in...
For a long time.
Eons.
So she... They say, well, you know...
She went into the hospital taking nothing.
Right. And then she came back with, you know...
For...
All
she had
kinds
some
of
her
drug
thyroid. Medicine. Yeah, she had quite a list of medications.
Right. So we... She was in for a couple, 3 days, and we brought her home, and she had this stent in her, and we explained to her, okay, here's the deal on your blood pressure medicine. They had one blood pressure medicine that maintain blood pressure, and a second one that if your blood pressure was too high, take this one to bring it down. And they had, you know, above 170, take the second one, blah, 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 blah. So, and there was times, and we had created a chart for her and how to do this. And so she went in and was taking her medicine, and we believe she mistook her medicine. Because I got a call, a panic call, saying she was dizzy and, you know, not feeling very good. And so I rushed over. This is about 3 or 4 days after her first visit to the emergency room. And she was, you know, feeling kind of fuzzy, she said, and dizzy. And she was sitting on her chair at the house and just not feeling right. So we took her to the emergency room again. So this is the second time. And they checked her blood pressure. And her blood pressure was very, very low. And we're like, okay, well, let's manage that, and they managed it, and she had an infection. Well, what happened was her stent had migrated. So the stent was meant to keep the common bile duct open, and it moved. So they had to go back in again a second time and do that procedure and reset the stent, and so they do that. And it's interesting, back in December, I had to deal with a medical emergency for my father. And it was an unpleasant situation that ended up working out okay. But he went from what I would argue was the brink of death on one day, and 4 days later they said it was time for him to go. And I thought, he can barely walk. He can't walk. Why are you sending him out of here? And a doctor pulled me inside and said, hospitals are the most dangerous place to be. And you want them out of here as soon as you possibly can, because there's lots of infections. Well, when they did the second procedure, we believe that she got an infection. Now, while this is going on, when you get an infection, a new doctor presents himself. So we had a GI doctor, we had an internal doctor, we had now an infectious disease doctor all working on mom. So she was weakened because of this infection. So she was in the hospital for a little while longer. And then they said they had to go to, I forget what the acronym, long-term.
Yeah, LTAC.
Long-term, what does it mean? Long-term acute care. Right. So it's a rehab facility. Here's an example of us not doing the right thing. So we, it's all very confusing. I have, my BlackBerry with a list of definitions of all these different kind of post-hospital care things. It's incredibly frustrating because it's hard to know what each one does. So the doctor who was assigned to us, who happened to be the infectious care guy, said, oh, you want to go to this particular place. And I forget the name of the place.
But we didn't check it out.
And we completely didn't check it out because we felt the doctor would be, straightforward with us.
Well, and I think that it was, too, also a situation where, I felt like it kind of sprung up on us quickly and a decision had to be made quickly.
Yeah, which brings up an interesting point. That's an excellent point, sweetie. Here's the other point. And we learned this, I think it was the third time we were there, and that is, if they say you are going to be discharged from the hospital, you can argue that. You can say, I'm not prepared to be discharged. And I don't think anybody knows that. We've been to that hospital 5 or 6 times. We were only told that one time. One time.
Well, it's in the paperwork they give you.
Right. But when you're, and that may be true, but the last thing you care about, besides giving your secret code, which they never asked me for when I called it about my mom, by the way, was I just want to take care of my mom. I'm not worried about these other rules. Well, if you think you're being discharged early, tell them you're not willing to go and fight it. And you're going to find out that if you fight with these people, if you argue against their argument, they will almost always acquiesce. Nonetheless, so we were told she needs to go to this rehab place to get her strength back because she couldn't walk well after the procedure and the infection. We went to this place down the street, and it was terrible.
Terrible. They did get her back on her feet.
Yeah, but she
didn't. She didn't like it because she didn't.
It was dirty.
It was run down.
It was run down. It was it was messy. There was dings on the walls. They were not responsive. There were people down the hall yelling and screaming and barking like dogs.
Well,
it was not a good place.
It wasn't a good place. It's acute care, and so at acute LTACs, you see a lot of people who are in comas, on life support. I mean, these are people that are very, very, very sick.
Yeah.
So,
or in some,
this is not, rehab.
But they have different groups of that, too. They have one wing that are people who are in comas and other wings who are like folks like my mom. So,
but there are very, very sick people there. This is the place where people really are. It's acute care because it could go bad very quickly.
Yeah. And so one of the things that became apparent to me at this point of the time was that doctors have a certain responsibility to be able to tell the story clearly. So the doctors who were assigned to her in the hospital then moved to this LTAC thing, this long-term acute care place. Same doctors, which makes sense. It's a continuity thing. I understand that. The problem with my mom was that it's, when you're there in the hospital and you've got these things going on, it's easy to be confused or scared by what's going on. So she'd have these doctors come in and talk to her and tell her, well, this is going on and this is happening and you've got this kind of infection and we're giving, and she couldn't remember any of it, none of it. And so when I would come in and try to get this information, well, there would be no doctors there. So I did two things. First, at the LTAC place, I created a sheet, a sign-in sheet, for everybody who walked into her room. And I told my mom, if anybody comes in your room, I don't care what they're doing. If they're bringing you food, I want them to sign who they are, why they're there, and what time they're there. so I could have a trail of who's saying what to who. And then the second thing that pissed me off was that the quarterback, the internist who was assigned to her, she came in and I asked her to explain to my mom what was going on. Now, it's the three of us in this LTAC facility. And this woman doctor proceeds to try to do this. And it was the most confusing, terrible description I'd ever heard of what was going on. I mean, it was horrible. Afterwards, I had summarized for her. I said, well, Mom, basically this doctor is supposed to be the quarterback. And her job is to explain to you, you know, what's going on from her position, which is this, and from the infectious disease, which is your infection is clearing up, and from the GI person, which is so far your stent's okay, and that's her job. And this doctor said, wow, that was a great job. And I was thinking to myself, you should have been able to do that without even thinking about it. Made me really angry and disappointed that this was going on. So we eventually got Mom out of LTAC, and we decided enough of this. She needs to stay with us. So we had her move in with us, you know, for a while to get her back on her feet. So she was getting a little better, and now at this point, she had a PICC line put in her arm so she could take antibiotics that would continue after being in this LTAC facility. And this was a tough time for her. She didn't like doing it, and so Melissa would do it.
Well, because they wanted you to do it. They wanted it to happen at home. So, you know, when you have to have something that's a regular intravenous thing, you know, if you're capable, you know, you or your caregivers can do it at home. You don't have to then go into a doctor's office because it had to happen every day.
Right.
So it's interesting. Your mom and I went and we got a little training on how to do this. And I learned all about PICC lines and how to flush PICC lines and how to administer the antibiotic. And then we taught you how to do it.
Right.
So we all knew how to do it.
Am I the person you want to give you your IV?
It was kind of complicated. It was a little, not, it, well, there were just some steps. So and I could, it's, it would be scary to have
It's probably 15 steps. And when you so at this point, Mom's began to be more and more scared.
Well, yeah, so she can't concentrate, you know?
Right. So what if I gave you, you know, these are the three steps, it'd be easy for anybody in this room to be able to do that. She was really struggling with that.
Well, you're putting something in your body, right?
Right.
I mean, that's
it's scary.
Yeah.
But we kept at it, and we were doing it. And then one day, a couple days after she'd been home, she, you know, called out to me while I was in my office and said she's got severe abdomen pain. And my mom's a tough broad, like I said, and I asked her, well, you know, they're going to ask you this question from 1 to 10. What's your pain? And she said 8. Which is bad. So I got her back in the car, and I raced back to Mountain View Hospital. As a matter of fact, I crossed over one of those medians to get her in the hospital quickly. So this time we got there, and here's the other tip. If you're going to go to emergency room, go early. We didn't get there until about 2. And for some reason, I don't know, full moon, hard to say, but every emergency room in Las Vegas was packed. People were sending people away.
They were diverting from, they actually were closing down emergency rooms because the hospitals were so, you know, just impacted. So they were doing what they called diverting. So they were diverting out further and further. Yeah. So a lot of people were getting diverted to Mountain View who maybe were trying to go to other hospitals.
So she was in at her peak 9 out of 10 pain for 8 hours.
Well, they were just bringing people in ambulances
and not even taking them back out in the freaking lobby.
It was really bad. I mean, that's not
bad.
A hospital thing. It's just there were that many people in Vegas.
As a matter of fact, I'd been there with her, watching her in pain for 4 hours, and I called Centennial Hospital, which is a hospital a little bit closer to our house, and said, "Hey, what's going on there? Any chance of us getting?" And they said, "Like, well." I said, we're in there. We've logged in basically, but we're waiting." She goes, "There are people here who've been here since 8 a.m. We still haven't seen them yet. Don't leave." Okay. So eventually we got her in there, and they gave her a drug called, and I always pronounce this wrong, it's Dilaudin. So Dilaudin, huh? What's that?
I'm just telling you to put your...
Oh, I'm sorry, thanks. Besides being a beautiful wife, she's a director.
But not a very good sign language person, I guess.
Oh, it's good. No, I like that. Dilaudin. Dilaudin is 10 times stronger than morphine. And so they gave her, I believe it was a milligram of Dilaudin, and her pain went away. Now, this is severe pain, 9 out of 10. It was unbelievable, and it went away. And so we're like, you know, thank God for that. And that lasted for about an hour or so. And then she started becoming uncomfortable again, and then she started to feel some real pain again. And this is in her abdomen, right side, which is where your pancreas is, by the way. And so they gave her another dose of Dilaudin. Now, meanwhile, remember, she's on high blood pressure medicine, so her blood pressure was lower than, I mean, normal-ish. They gave her this Dilaudin, and then she became unresponsive. Well, no, actually, it wasn't that quick. They moved her then to a room, you know, on the third floor or whatever it was, and she became more and more unresponsive, where she wouldn't respond to anything. Hi, Mom. Shake, tap, 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 nothing. Checked her blood pressure. Her blood pressure was something in the 90 over 60 range, and I think it dropped to like 70 over something.
60 over 30.
60 over, it was, is that what it was? 60 over 30. And so, you know, when you're in a hospital, you hear these, you know, code blue, code red, code white, and we learned all these, and one of them is emergency response team, room 301, emergency response, and we were like, well, I wonder what that is. Well, now I can tell you what that is, because that's what happened to Mom. She was unresponsive. Her blood pressure was so low that they called the emergency response team for my mom. I will tell you that to that moment, that was the most frightening thing I'd ever seen, but also one of the most impressive things I'd ever seen. So I was scared, and I was crying and worried, and they tipped her head down. So the blood would rush to her brain, we're assuming, to keep her the blood in her brain, and that increases blood pressure. Oh, by the way, they'd given her 2 liters of fluid in her, you know, IV fluid, because as you add more volume to your veins, that in itself increases blood pressure naturally, just physics. But none of that was working. So they did this emergency response team, and within, I don't know, 2-3 minutes, 4 or 5 people showed up with a, you know, carts and stuff, and we just sat and watched. And fortunately, this particular drug, morphine, there is an anti-drug for this.
Dilaudin.
There's an anti-drug for this, which they administered her, and like that, she came right out of it. Now, her blood pressure was still low, but she was responsive. It was one of the most amazing things I'd ever experienced.
Well, it was really interesting because they were paying no attention to us, and they just swarmed in there, and there was like, you know, hooking her up to stuff. One nurse was doing one thing, someone else was doing something else, and it was just like a full, like, what do you say, like an attack almost on her, you know, just everyone doing something different, needle syringes coming out. Right. And then, you know, all of a sudden, you know, she started blinking her eyes. It was very bizarre. It was definitely.
Yeah, to that point, it was the most scary. Unpleasant, scary thing. They ended up putting her in the ICU because she had an infection again.
Well, and because her blood pressure had dropped so low.
They wanted to keep it track.
Yeah. I mean, pretty quickly, as soon as she started blinking, the next thing, you know, within a couple minutes, they had the rails up, and they were taking her to ICU.
Right. So this is a good example of some great experience there. The ICU people there were fantastic. The nurses were fantastic. You know, very attentive, very concerned with the family as well. And so I felt that was a good experience there. She eventually got her strength back and got her health back, and she went home again. And then a fourth event took place. And
meanwhile, every time she goes to the hospital, she's having, in that particular episode.
I forgot.
they ended up, every time she goes in, they've had to do, replace the stents moving.
The stent moved.
So on the third time, they put two stents side by side. So, you know, we thought those would do really well.
Side by side because there's more physical pressure there. They're less likely to slip.
Yeah. She also got sent to Centennial Hills to have an endo ultrasound
right.
thing done. And I think Centennial Hills is the only place where they can do that procedure. Trying to see if they can find the cause of the stricture.
That's right. That's a good point. So they sent her to Centennial Hills. There's only one doctor in the whole area who does this procedure. It's only one machine that's capable of doing that, and that was in Centennial Health. So we went there. They did the procedure, and it came back negative. They didn't have anything.
They couldn't see anything. Any gross or anything causing the stricture.
We've been dealing with the stricture. She's had three
of these procedures. The biopsies are all coming back
Everything's
clean.
Looking great. We're like, you know, what in the hell is going on? So she got, was it pain or was it weakness again? I forget.
Weakness. The only pain was caused by the pancreatitis from the infection.
So we went back a fourth time and do another one of these things and do another scraping. And this time they came back and said she had cancer.
They also put in two stents again, but a different kind of stent
that
did indeed hold.
So we've gone through this, and we were told, she was finally told by herself, which made me feel like a terrible son, that she had cancer. That she was told she had cancer of the common bile duct. So obviously, the first thing we did is we did research of cancer of the common bile duct, and didn't seem so bad. So,
and told that because the cells were found in the bile duct.
Right. And so they said, okay, well, we've got somebody here locally that does a procedure referred to as a Whipple procedure. Whipple procedure is a pretty major surgery. I've later come to meet somebody whose friend had it, and it's a brutal procedure. And what they do is they remove part of your pancreas, part of your stomach, your common bile. They replace it. They remove your gallbladder. They change part of your lower or your upper abdomen or intestines. It's a big deal. Anyways, they said, we've got a local guy here. And at this point, I forgot. So after the second visit, we went to the third time when she had the low blood pressure and needed to be recovered. And they said, we have you as your doctor is this person, this person, this person. And I fired all three of them. And so here the first message I would like to convey to folks is, you get to decide who your doctor is. It's up to you. And so I was so fed up with these are the same folks who helped her the first time and the second time. They were so incompetent in my mind, and it was this one doc, I mean, all of them.
Mostly in their ability to communicate.
Well, communicate, they sent us to a crappy place, they sucked at communications, and they were wrong on half the things that they said, just wrong. So I decided enough. So I fired three doctors right then and there in the emergency room. Got three other ones that were better. And the reason why I'm telling you this is because this environment is incredibly intimidating. You've got nurses running around who are understaffed. You've got doctors speaking at a level here when we're all at a level here. It's very easy to be scared or confused. And I just had enough. And I just said, I don't want them. I want other people. And they gave it to me without even blinking an eye.
But I think most people don't. I think most people, when they go to the hospital, think you have to deal with whoever you're given.
And you don't.
And they don't realize that you can request other doctors. You can request second opinions,
right.
too.
And this happened another time later on. So on the fourth time we went in, they did the scraping. They did find angiocarcinograph or whatever it was called, cancer. And they said, we've got this Whipple procedure, blah, 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 blah. At this point, I said, all right, enough of this. We decided, based upon where we live, we needed to go to what is often thought of as probably the best medical facility in the world, and that's Mayo Clinic. There's a Mayo Clinic in Arizona, in Scottsdale. So we were able to get an appointment our GI guy, who I'm not a real big fan of, to be honest with you. I didn't think he was great. I mean, he had ended up doing this four times. I consider that a problem. And the only reason why I didn't fire this guy is because my mom liked him. I didn't want my mom to be upset. But I thought he was incompetent. His ratings online were poor, but somehow he didn't. Actually, he and I got in a little bit of a pissing contest. He told you that he didn't want to, what was it? He didn't want to be around me or something because I made him uncomfortable, or I forget what it was.
No, he actually was recommending that perhaps, you know, we would want
elsewhere.
Another doctor, yeah. Because he was feeling that tension from you.
Yeah.
And he, which is the right thing, right? Is he actually said, you know, look, do you want a different doctor? I'm feeling this tension from your husband. You know, he and I are not, you know, communicating very well. You know, if you want another doctor, I can do that. He actually volunteered
yeah.
that.
And so my mom really liked him, and they got along well. And this was a real hard decision for me, but I wanted my mom to be happy, so I said okay. So we went to the Mayo Clinic. And I will tell you what, it was such an amazing experience there. I've never seen a better run organization in any kind of organization in my life. I mean, they send you your itinerary before you show up. The time when they say you're going to meet somebody at 10:15, you're going to meet them at 10:15. As a matter of fact, the first time we got there, you know, we go in and do our entry stuff, and we, you know, blood's taken or whatever, and we go, I forget what the first, I think she had to get an MRI or whatever. And as we're done with the MRI, we're walking back to wait for a couple hours for our appointment with the actual doctor. The doctor called me directly, the doctor, and said, hey, if you've got time, I can see you now.
Yeah, we thought that was crazy.
Okay. Sounds good, doc. We'll be there in a minute. And, you know, we saw the doctor an hour early. Where does that happen? But at the Mayo Clinic. I don't know. It's crazy. So,
you know what I thought was interesting about the itinerary? It reminded me of, you ever go to a trade show or conference and they have everything listed? Okay, this is the check-in. This is the reception.
Yep.
This is going to be your interviews or your, you know, seminar sessions.
Yep.
That's kind of how it was laid out.
Exactly.
And there was a map. Where all you need to go. I mean, it was very incredibly well organized.
It was
but
most
it was like
impressive
that kind of itinerary.
Yeah, it was stunning. So we met with the doctor, and the doctor said, well, you know, in looking at this and looking at the second
he had already seen all the MRI results.
Right. And looking at the other stuff, you don't have common bile duct cancer, you have pancreatic cancer. So it took a month. To get that diagnosis.
Well, no, it took longer than that. It was diagnosed on March 27th.
Oh, so almost 2 months.
And yeah. We were there early February.
Early February. Before, yeah. So it took over a month to diagnose pancreatic cancer. That's not good. As a matter of fact, that's actually in complete bullshit. And there's no reason for that. And that pisses me off. And I can't express to you the amount of anger I have for not being able to catch that in time.
Well, they were doing scrapings and biopsies. And I mean, not just one. When they would go in there.
Well, the cat who did the deal over at the other hospital should have caught it. Because there was.
You mean the ultrasound, the endo ultrasound?
Yeah, because the guys at Mayo saw that and go, I'm not sure why they said what they said, but it's pretty clear. And as we compare it with what we've done here, it's pancreatic cancer.
But they did say they didn't, even the Mayo doctors didn't see it on the image that he took.
Oh, I thought he did. Mm-hmm. Okay.
What they saw wasn't the image that he took. What happened was when they did the MRI, they saw that it had metastasized to her liver.
Oh, that was the other thing. So that was seen by the guy over at the Centennial Hill. And they thought it was just lesions.
Yes.
Yeah.
But
in other words, you're seeing it, all this is going on, and we're trying to keep hope. And so we finally got the diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. And as you know, most people know, that is a grim diagnosis. My mom did not want to know what the outlook was. A lot of people, you know, if you tell them you've got X cancer, they'll say, well, how much time do I have to live, doc? And mom was the opposite. She said, it doesn't really matter. I just want to know what we can do to fight it, which I kind of dug. Now, of course, I went and did the research, and Melissa did the research. And pancreatic cancer is a grim diagnosis. And you know, without any kind of support, you're 6 months. If you get one kind of chemo, you're 9 months or 8 months. And another, it's 9 or 10 months. It's grim. But she didn't want to know. So we then asked for a referral for an oncologist here in Las Vegas, because it didn't make sense for us to drive to Mayo Clinic every week to do chemotherapy. And it was interesting, because at Mayo we said, mom said, I want to go on a trial. I want the most aggressive, I want it all. And the Mayo doctor was actually a little reticent to that. Blah, blah, blah. And I kind of talked to him after the fact.
Well, he wanted to do a very aggressive chemo treatment.
No, not the Mayo Clinic didn't. The other one did. The Mayo Clinic actually suggested the least aggressive of the two options. There's three options. There was one chemo, more aggressive chemo, and trial-based. He suggested the least aggressive. Mom wanted the most aggressive or trial. He had no say in these two. So what we said was, it doesn't make sense for us to come here for chemo. What we'd like to do is be able to have somebody in Las Vegas. So he provided us a referral to a Dr. Brette, and I'm bringing him up because it was the most impressive consult we've had in the entire time we did any of this. He's with a comprehensive cancer center in Las Vegas. They account for 60% of our cancer treatment in Las Vegas. So we were sent to they've got two properties. They've got one on the west side, and they've got one over on Eastern. And so we met Dr. Brette, and stunningly impressive. His first line was, I think we'll put you on trial. I don't treat cancer victims. I don't treat cancer. I treat patients. And we're going to go after this. And it was very, very impressive. I felt better. My mom, you could see the weight lifted off of her. I mean, you could tell this guy is going to get at it. So it was one of the very first times where I met a doctor and thought, you know what? There's hope. And I pulled everybody aside. Mom didn't want to know, but I wanted to know. And I said, I've looked at the numbers. These numbers are grim. Have you any... you're talking some good news. Have you ever had anybody do good news? He goes, yeah, we've had people live years with pancreatic cancer. It's possible. I can't promise it, but it's possible. Well, that's great, So there was a couple weeks break between when, we knew it was pancreatic cancer and we were going to get on the trial and we were going to get started. So we were feeling relatively optimistic based upon the procedure, but mom started to feel a little... I could tell she was starting to feel afraid and nervous and concerned about what was happening. Then one morning we got a call, or I got a call, and it was her housekeeper who said that my mom had fallen and was on the floor and she couldn't pick her up by herself. So I got on the phone with her and tried to talk to her, and she wasn't able to communicate very well. And I started to get angry with her a little bit, feel pretty bad about that. And it's like, come on, mom, just, what's going on? And she was, mom doesn't swear, didn't like when I swore, but she was swearing a lot, and that was unusual for her. So I drove to her house, ran to her, pretty quickly, got in there, and she was on the floor, on the marble floor in her bath, or in her kitchen. And so the housekeeper had brought a chair behind her, and we picked her up and put her on there. And she couldn't focus. She wouldn't look at me. She couldn't feel her left leg, her right leg, actually. Her eyes were kind of wandering, and I was very, very concerned. So I called 911. 911 showed up, and they thought, well, I think she may have had a stroke. And so it seemed pretty clear that there was something not quite right. They put her in the ambulance, took an unpleasantly long time to get her to the hospital, but they brought her in, and she started to recover pretty quickly. Before, she wasn't really able to talk much. She was perfectly capable of conversation. She was slurring a few words, She couldn't say, for example, the word marble, as in I was on the marble floor. But she was complaining about being thirsty. One of the things they worry about with stroke victims is, can you swallow? Well, she couldn't wait for that. And they thought she had a TIA, which was a transient ischemic attack. And what that is a basically a spasm in your brain that stops blood flow, like a stroke. It's called a mini stroke. When the blood comes back, everything's fine. And they thought she had had that for a moment because she seemed pretty capable. But they brought her in and did an MRI, or a CT scan and MRI, and they had found that she actually had three strokes in a line on this one particular peripheral area, on her right side, I think it was. So we were now dealing with that. And another great, so that was bad news, and nobody was happy about that. But what we did learn was Mountain View had a new rehab center. And we had taken a look at it while she was in the hospital, and it was stunning. It was absolutely amazing. Great people, smiles, the patients seemed to be in a good place. And we got her into the rehab center over in the Mountain View place. But before that, here's where I fired an entire floor of nurses. So she had this stroke, and while she could talk clearly, and my mom was a pretty bright gal, and she spoke clearly, had a very large vocabulary, and it fooled people. They thought she was in better shape than she was. So when they brought her food, they figured she could feed herself, but her hand-eye coordination was terrible. You know, in the beginning, if you asked her to touch your finger and then touch her nose, she couldn't do it. So when they brought in her food, she couldn't feed herself. The spoon was upside down. You know, her spatial awareness was messed up. So I came in one day in the morning, you know, before off to work, and she had food kind of spilled on her. And I asked her, what's going on here? And she said, well, I'm spilling food. I can't do this. And that really made me angry. So I called a nurse in and said, why would you allow this to happen? And she didn't have a good answer. And so at Mountain View, there are five floors in the hospital. The fifth floor is all the rooms are set with cameras.
Well, the thing that's concerning about that is there was hot coffee and things like that where your mom really could have hurt herself. Mm. I mean, it's not just that she was a mess. There was hot coffee, and she could have really hurt herself.
I was concerned with all of those things. So we had been on the fifth floor in one of those episodes before, and there's a camera in every room. And so I said to the nurse, actually, I went out to the nurse's station and said, I want my mom off this floor. I want it done in an hour because I want somebody to keep an eye on her. So I fired an entire floor of nurses. And an hour later, she was moved to the fifth floor. So this is another lesson. I probably didn't handle it as gently as I could, but you're allowed to fire nurses as well. And I did that again later on. These people work for us. And whether they're overworked or not, I would argue that they are overworked. There was too many things going on for the nurses I saw, especially in the day. But it doesn't matter. If this is your loved one or your friend or a family member, you get to decide how they're treated. And if they're not treated fairly, fight for their rights to be treated properly. So we moved her to the fifth floor. And after a while, we moved her to rehab. And rehab started off as being an absolutely amazing experience for us. She loved it there. It was brand new. The people were great. They were walking her. Usually in rehab, when they say you're in rehab, what that really means is you're doing about an hour and a half of rehab a day. And here they're doing 3 hours, which is a lot of work. And it's mental and physical. Like, my mom was unable to spell her name, but she could read. She couldn't tell time. She had trouble drawing a circle. But she could speak, she could converse very clearly. So it was a really weird
scene. Well, she had some trouble with some words.
Yeah,
I mean, it wasn't like completely unaffected. I mean, she was still affected, but it, you know, wasn't.
That's true. But she could more or less get across right. anything that she wanted yeah. to say. Now, during this, when you have a stroke, they're worried about more strokes. So they gave her a drug called heparin, which is a blood thinner. Heparin is a fast-acting drug, meaning that if you take it out of you within an hour or so, it stops thinning your blood. So the protocol typically is you go on heparin for a certain amount of time, you get yourself stabilized, and you go on another drug, I believe it's called Coumadin, which is also a blood-thinning drug that lasts longer. And so that was the plan. And so this is a part where I feel like I didn't do a very good job. And they had her on heparin, and I noticed that they were kind of moving her dosage day by day to try to get something stable.
Well, they have to lower heparin as they're bringing the Coumadin up.
But what I was saying
was... They don't. Right. They can't just cut off heparin because it takes a while for the Coumadin, because
right.
it is long-lasting, to build up.
Right.
So they kind of have to...
Which is not what I saw. What I saw was heparin going up higher and higher and higher and higher. I didn't,
oh.
Yeah.
So, but once they get it to where it needs to be, they don't just cut it off.
Right. So she was there for a couple weeks in rehab. And, gosh, things were going good. She was actually walking better than she'd ever walked in the last, well, since she's been in Vegas. They taught her a new technique. It was pretty cool. But then one day, Thursday, they discovered some internal bleeding. And so that was very concerning to them. And they took her immediately off of the heparin Coumadin drug. Well, as a result of the bleeding, her hemoglobins were low. And to solve that, you get a transfusion. Now, she had already had a transfusion during this entire time. Wasn't a big deal to her. I was in there on a Thursday afternoon talking to her about it. They were going to do the transfusion maybe an hour after I'd been there. The next morning, Friday morning, Melissa came to visit her, and she had another stroke. And this was a bad one. She was, you know, saying things over and over again, definitely not cognizant.
Well, didn't recognize us.
Didn't recognize us, saying things, don't be afraid. And it was pretty bad. And during this previous time, she had two MRIs. The first one was a full body one that she really didn't like. And the second one was a brain MRI that we'd given her a drug to calm her down, and it worked real well. So I said, we need to have another MRI to see what was going on. And they gave her the drug they had given her before, and it had, instead of calming her, it had the opposite effect on her. And this sometimes happened. This is nobody's fault, but it was very unpleasant. So she became very irritated, agitated, and she was trying to get out of the bed as they were taking her down to the MRI. So there weren't a lot of times where I thought people were just shit. But twice of them was the MRI people. There was a guy and a gal there who, when my mom showed up, she was kind of, you know, agitated. And the first thing he said, the very first thing out of his mouth is, well, we're not going to do this MRI. Now, you know, I'm panicked. My mom is freaked out. She's had a second stroke, I'm guessing. And I've got this guy with an attitude telling me he's not going to do something. So he and I had a couple words about that, and I convinced him that that was probably not the right way to move. And they eventually did an MRI. He later told me that he had to actually lay on top of her to keep her from moving. They couldn't do a full one, but they did a partial one, and they found another stroke. So they put her back in the hospital, and we dealt with this for a while. At this point, we decided we needed to bring, you know, family in my thinking was I wanted to wake her up. So I brought in my guitar and played guitar for her. I brought in the music that I had done. I brought in a photo album, and she was responding to these things. She could go through the photo album, not speak, she couldn't speak, but she could point and you know, where's your brother, boink. She could, you know, she was able to recognize who I was. When people would come into the room, she would know who they were. She just couldn't articulate it.
Well, she was talking, but, like, not all the words made sense.
Right.
She was making, it's not that she was
mute. A lot of gibberish.
She wasn't mute.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was, you know, every few words would be a real word.
And, right.
You know, very basic sentence structure.
Right. And so I had her brother, Jim, come in, and I had Pam and Heather fly in.
And Savannah?
Heather and Savannah fly in, which are my daughters, to see her. And so when Jim came in, mom recognized him and, you know, lit up like a, you know, and Pam and lit up. And it was all very good. I mean, not Pam. I'm sorry. Savannah. And it was all very positive. And then, and she started to start, you know, stringing sentences together. And I thought, wow, this is really working. And this was on a Monday. And so on a Monday that night, I had to attend to a business meeting. And so Jim and Savannah and Melissa were there. And mom was starting to even converse more. And she was saying, you know, I'm going to fight this. I'm not going to be an idiot. Speaking about, you know, her mental condition. And I'd heard about that when everybody got home. I'm like, this is great. Well, that whole night, she never fell asleep. They had a babysitter there watching her because she had been irritable before and they didn't want her to fall out of bed. So that whole Monday night, she didn't fall asleep and she was kind of thrashing about. And we got in there, Savannah and I got in there Tuesday morning and spent the whole day, and she didn't sleep the whole day. You know, her eyes were bloodshot, and she was just really struggling. And it was heartbreaking. It was just very difficult.
So what ended up happening was she did finally go to sleep that Tuesday night. So, you know, she had a very, you know, anxious day, very active. We think that it was, again, they had given her a sedative.
Yeah, I'm back.
And it had that opposite effect.
Yeah, they gave
again,
her
where instead of making her tired, it made her super anxious again.
They gave her an antipsychotic drug. And it had the opposite effect. And it's a long-acting drug. It was by 18 hours. So Savannah and I kept, like, we were trying to pretend to fall asleep, to get her to fall asleep, which didn't work much. But about 6:30 or so, she eventually fell asleep. And I decided I needed to spend the night with her just to make sure she'd be okay. So at 7 o'clock is when the nurses change. And so I'm laying there, you know, watching her with the babysitter, and this little gal comes walking in, just talking at the top of her lungs. Now, my mom had just fallen asleep an hour after being awake for 24 hours. And I was having none of it. So I said, shh, she just fell asleep. And this nurse said, I don't have to shush. I can talk any way I want. And I wasn't going to have any of that either. So I got up and, you know, she came to about here on me. And I said, you don't understand. I need you to be quiet now. My mom just fell asleep. Because I can talk any way I want. I said, you don't understand. And she said, Jesus Christ. And I said, I actually got a little Melissa in me. I said, we need to have a conversation with your boss. Go get your boss. So she took off, got her boss, and I decided to go out there and meet her boss. And her boss was amazing. She understood my position. She understood I was concerned, and she removed that nurse immediately. So again, you can fire nurses, and I did. And we brought another nurse in here who did just a fine job. Now, as I spent the night, you know, my mom was sleeping and seemed to be kind of moving around a lot, but she was, you know, sleeping, it seemed like. And about 3 in the morning, they kind of checked on her and, you know, gave her kind of a sponge back, changed her linens, and they moved her over, and her leg fell, and she said, ouch, so things were good. The bad news was she never woke up. And she was like that throughout the rest of her life. And this, you know, this brought up a whole new environment for us. The, you know, the concepts of what do you do when somebody is no longer responsive. And we got glimmers of hope, but also we learned a lot about, you know, what reality is in an unconscious state. You know, occasionally she would slightly open her eyes, but she couldn't focus. And I, you know, I thought, oh, this is a sign where she's coming back. And they look for what are referred to as primitive responses. So a primitive response, for example, is when a baby is first born, they grab your hand. You put your finger in a baby's hand, it will grab it. It's primitive. So she was doing that a little bit with her right hand. A primitive response, well, if you put your feet out and if somebody scrapes the bottom of your foot, your natural response is to curl your toes and put away. Primitive response is to splay your toes out. another great example of people who you can tell care was the physical therapist we had there. I wish I remembered her name. She was simply amazing. I mean, this is a woman who had been unconscious for days, and she was in there doing the exercises, trying to do the right thing. It was stunning how great she was. And I told her that over and over again, that we were very impressed. But after a certain amount of time, then you know, you come into the medical directive world. And this you know, comes down to, you know, are you taking care of yourself? Are you doing the right things for your family? Are you setting the right expectations in case you become unconscious? And so Mom's medical directive was, if she was diagnosed by two doctors as being permanently unconscious, then to provide a week's worth of nutrition and fluids. Well, come to find out, no doctor wants to say that. No doctor will tell you that somebody is permanently unconscious. I'm assuming they're afraid of lawsuits or whatever, but it was very, very difficult to be able to get that, which made it very hard for us to know what to do. But eventually we decided that we needed to get her on the nutrition and the hydration. There's a certain kind, I think it's called TPN, I forget the name of it now, which is the nutrition is based upon your body chemistry. And so I told our doctor, now this is probably the third or fourth internist doctor that we had, that I wanted TPN started
that day,
that night. Told him that was very clear, he understood. Next morning I came in and he hadn't done it. So I called him and I fired him and I told him I wanted another doctor. And the protocol there actually is, if you fire a doctor, you're supposed to bring in your own doctor, which put a little bit of pressure on me. I was very worried about that. I actually reached out to my cardiologist, who ended up being my mom's cardiologist. She needed to go see him to see if she was capable of that Whipple procedure, Dr. Kazemi, and he had provided some sources of internists for that. But the doctor who I fired, who started every sentence with, to tell the truth, which is not a good way to start a sentence in my book, he actually provided another doctor who was great. He called me every day and let me know what was going on. So we did that for a week. During this time, you have to recognize, you know, what are the possible outcomes here, and all of them are grim and not pleasant. And then it becomes time to, you know, what does your mom want? And Mom had always told us that she lived a great life and she would never want to be in a vegetative state, which she was in. And so we had done some research with hospice, and you know, I will tell you up front, I'm scared to death of death. And so the concept of speaking to people whose job is to make death comfortable is an unpleasant conversation for me to have. Hospice works in a couple of ways. One of them, you could be in a long-term, I forgot to mention this. During this time while she was unconscious, her husband, who had been in a memory care facility, Aegis, who, by the way, is outstanding, for a year and a half, died. So in the course of what ended up being 11 days, my stepfather and my mother died. And so we decided to tell my mom that that Dick had died during that time, and she was unconscious, but your mom had suggested we do that, and I thought that was the right thing to do. So now we're dealing with that, and at the same time, I'm trying to deal with how best to take care of my mom. And so we visited the Aegis in care facility and resident facility, which was also attached to the Mountain View Hospital.
Hospice. You mean the Nathan Adelson. Not Aegis.
Thank you. The Nathan Adelson Hospice, which is attached to the Mountain View Hospital. So it's on the third floor. And once again, very impressed with what we saw there. Private rooms. Their focus is comfort. And so we decided after a week of her being unconscious and being on this the nutrition and hydration that instead of the doctor actually said, well, let's send her to an LTAC, a long-term, you know, acute facility. And it didn't make any sense. There was nothing to be gained there.
We were also looking at, you know, should we get in-home care? Right. What's the right thing to do?
And we decided that what I wanted was the best possible care. And if she got better at hospice, then we could take her out. So it's not like you have to go in and you can never come out. So we made that decision that we would have her go to hospice. And so that's an unpleasant walk, I will tell you. I walked her with her, you know, on the gurney to the hospice state. But I will tell you, the most amazing experience I saw was at hospice. The most caring group of people action was at hospice. When she got there, when she was wheeled in there, she was there was an announcement, new patient, room B1. And they walked her, you know, they wheeled her into the room, and within 30 seconds, three RNs were there, just like that. One was washing her hair, calling her Miss Nancy, and one was cleaning her up, changing her linens, changing her, you know, her undergarments and all. And it was just the most amazing thing I'd ever seen. So I felt like it was a good place to be. It sucked to be there, but it was a good place to be. Now, these guys have a different, you know, thinking process. Their process is comfort. Now, we were on, when we were giving her this nutrition, a lot of people believe that it was causing some phlegm in her throat. And she was having some real problems breathing in the hospital, real phlegmy. And it was very unpleasant to watch. So we changed the nutrition they were provided at Nathan Adelson. And they also gave her a medicine, and boom, cleared up her breathing right away. And so we basically said that for a certain amount of time, we wanted her on the hydration / nutrition that they provided. And if nothing got better, then we would take her off that. And that's what we ended up doing.
Well, we were just trying to honor her directive. And I think a real lesson here about directives, because we had such a hard time with the directive. And really, you know, the doctors were very hesitant to the directive. You know, she really just went to a lawyer, and the lawyer is the one who advised her on the directive. But I think it also, you should also talk about your directive with a doctor. And is this a reasonable request? And this is something that you should do as part of the overall planning of your estate. If you think, I'll deal with that when I need to, you may be unconscious and not able to deal with it. Yep. And so, you know, one of the really great lessons we learned out of this is the need to have a directive or a living will that you not only talk about with your lawyer, but talk about with your director, so you don't end up in a position where someone's going permanently unconscious. No, I'm not willing to say that. So that was a great lesson we learned. And so when we were in hospice, we were doing our best to try to honor the directive as best as we could in keeping her on, you know, hydration and nutrition for a certain amount of time.
Right.
And we were just trying to honor that as best as we could.
Right.
You know, in the end, we had a lot of conversation about this, you and I. You know, there's sort of, you know, I guess a silver lining to this end that she didn't have to deal with the cancer. You know, at the end, she wasn't at the end aware even that she had cancer.
And that was when I spoke at her funeral, and I've talked to a few people as a result of all this. She cured cancer in her head. After her second stroke, she no longer was aware that she had pancreatic cancer that had metastasized and was at the time raging in her body. There's another measurement, a tumor marker in your blood that should be very low. And when she was first diagnosed, it was at 2,000. When she was after her second stroke, it was at 16,000. So it was bad news there. But because of the second stroke, she had cured it. She didn't know she had it. I could argue that she might have her body may have generated the second stroke to stop it. Anyway, so we were out one night at on the strip with some friends, and we got a call that said that she had passed. And so we went home, you know, got some paperwork, went there and saw her again. And it was funny. I remember when they first moved here that they hung out at the
Suncoast
Casino. They had an Italian restaurant that included $1.50 wine. She thought that was outstanding. And so we would.
She liked a good bargain.
Yeah. So we would go there with her, you know, a few times while that was still going on. And we decided, after having, you know, said our final goodbyes after she'd passed, at 4:30 in the morning, we went to Suncoast and we lifted a glass to both Dick and her mom and my mom, and left it at that. So, what I want to convey here is a couple of things. First of all, it's okay to say no to people. It's okay to say no to doctors. It's okay to say no to nurses. You should say no. It's okay to look for the best there is, for the best help you can get. A couple of things have come out of this that I think are important. One of them is, Melissa talked about this, is having your estate intact. You know, a power of attorney, that was helpful. Having a power of attorney for my mom made many things go well. And it also helped kind of force some issues. For example, during this time, you know, this was really weird. So my mom's estate, my mom and her husband's estate, their house was not deeded properly in my mind, looking back at it. It didn't have a right of survivorship. It was just a joint. Well, or I forget the exact term, but basically, if one person passed, it didn't automatically go to the other person. That has caused a significant amount of problems today. We're now in probate as a result of that. You know, and part of the time I was there when Mom was in the hospital with her stroke, I felt like I should go and create a trust to solve that problem, but it felt bad, like I shouldn't be doing that. I should be worried about the medical stuff instead of trying to manage the estate after she passed away. So that was a really rough thing for me. As I look back at it, it would have been the right thing to do, but it didn't feel like the karmically right thing to do, so I didn't do it. But you know, having a power of attorney is important, having a medical directive important. A will means nothing. If you've got enough value in your estate, a will, all a will does is say, this is kind of how we want it, but it's still going to probate. What you really need is a living trust. And you want to make sure that your deed, if you own a home, is written properly so there's right of survivorship, so that it's handled well. The other thing that I think's important to know is that while there are some positive things here and a lot of negative things, there is a silver lining that I think is in front of us. And that is, there's an organization in town that's working to solve much of the problems that we're all facing. So, you know, what happened here is we kind of just felt our way through this. We didn't know who to go, who was the best, you know, gastrointestinal guy, who was the best oncologist, who was the best infectious disease. We didn't know, and we didn't know where to go, you know. And, you know, we did get some help for her internist. That was, I think, Kazemi provided that. I think it was him. So that was a little helpful. But that's not right. I think it's just crap, to be honest with you. Well, there's an organization of folks here who are looking to solve that problem. They're going to create a website, a database, where they go out and vet doctors for you. So it's not about how much you pay to get into this group. It's they're going to go in and go into, you know, the initial vetting is this database that we all kind of have access to, but none of us know how to do it. Well, they do. And they're going to see who are the best at all the different disciplines. It's under the heading of this term medical
tourism.
Medical tourism, which I think actually weakens what this is about. But come to find out, there are some doctors here who are best of breed. But you may not know that. I certainly wouldn't know it during a lot of what I've gone through, although I say my cardiologist is best of breed. But what these guys are going to do is create a database, an environment, a website, where if you need help with an intestinal problem, you know where to go, who's the best. And like I said, you can't buy into this. And I'm happy to say that we've been asked to help them with that. The Vegas Video Network has been asked to help them with that. And I don't know to what extent we're going to be able to do that or how we're going to help them, but I'm excited to be able to do something that I think, if it happens the way I've been told it will happen, will be great for this community. And I've been told that other great organizations, many who we've talked about today, are interested in being in Las Vegas. So I think there's good news coming from what has happened, you know, what we're aware of. And you can bet that I'm going to work very, very hard to make sure that anybody who needs this information will get it from us. That I can promise you. Okay? So that's it. Anything else?
I think we're going to have a lot to talk about. You know, we talked, this was a very long show, talking about, you know, healthcare stuff. But I think going forward, we're going to have a lot of information to share about, you know, estate planning, probate, as you and I want to get our, you know, go through that for our own finances, and we're going through probate with your mom's house. So I think we'll have a lot more pointers and tips and experience to share with you all about that as we experience that ourselves. Yeah. So as we do, I'm sure we'll have shows talking about that along the way.
And we'll occasionally talk about fun stuff too, if all goes well. but that's it. Probably not the happiest of subjects, but we thought it was an important subject. We appreciate you you hanging in there with us on this. And if you guys have any questions that we didn't cover on this, you know how to reach out to us. onairq@livinginlv.com would be the email address. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions I can possibly provide. I'm going to skip all the other contact stuff, but you know, email or the voicemail, the web-based voicemail, you could reach us that as well. Again, this is Scott Whitney. Melissa Whitney, this Living in Las Vegas podcast on the Vegas Video Network. We'll see you guys next week. Take care. Bye-bye.